This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Beth Voorhees. It's 7:33. Legislators got their first look at a bill that would legalize the medicinal use of marijuana in the state. A controversial proposal. Ashton Mara reports lawmakers are taking their time scrutinizing the legislation before they even decide to present it to the full legislature for consideration.
Members of the Joint Committee on Health were handed their first draft of the proposed medical marijuana bill during an interim meeting at the Capitol. Committee Chair Delegate Don Perdue says it's time for the legislature to mull over the idea of presenting the bill for consideration.
We have talked about everything in a sort of an anecdotal way, in a less than necessarily real sense. Now they've got something real, a real document.
The comprehensive bill is a compilation of medical marijuana laws from multiple other states and sets forth five provisions. The first is setting up a patient registry through the State Department of Health and Human Resources. With a doctor's prescription, a patient can go to the agency and receive an identification card allowing the purchase of medicinal marijuana. Once that card is obtained, the bill allows for the creation of compassion centers, in other words, dispensaries. Those will be selected by the DHHR through a competitive bidding process, and only five will be licensed the first year the bill takes effect. The draft legislation also limits the amount of marijuana each registered patient is allowed to possess, set at 6 ounces, 12 mature plants, and 12 seedlings. A designated caregiver, like an in-home nurse or hospice worker, is allowed to oversee the medical supply for up to 5 patients. Ailments eligible for treatment include things like cancer, glaucoma, and PTSD, and valid registration cards from other states will be recognized in West Virginia dispensaries. The draft bill differs from other states, however, in the way marijuana is taxed. Delegate Mike Manupenny helped write this version of the bill.
Taxes collected would be put into a special fund which could be used for substance abuse treatment in the community and drug prevention in our schools to try to create balance from the substance abuse problem that we have in the state, because we don't have enough funding now to treat all the patients that have substance abuse problems.
But Purdue says this draft legislation is just that, a draft. Committee members will propose changes over the next few weeks. Purdue says he will continue to assess their feelings on whether to introduce the bill when the legislature goes into session in January.
I have to divorce myself from my personal opinion until I hear what the committee's got to say. We really have to do that. We're duty-bound to do that. And as you see, through the rest of this session, when we come into the session, we start looking at these pieces of legislation. We got several. Then you'll see that we'll either come out with a recommendation, or we'll come out with no recommendation, or we won't move it at all and ask to continue the study.
And there are some concerns with the proposed bill, particularly from across the aisle. Delegate Kelly Sabonia questioned whether there could be a problem with people using fake IDs to obtain the drug, an issue Manupenny says can be addressed.
Maybe we can work a little bit on doing some type of a watermark or a hologram that fits into the ID to make it more difficult to fraudulently create one.
Senator Chris Walters is concerned with legal ramifications should the federal government begin to pursue cases against citizens certified by the state to legally possess the medicine.
If the next administration, whether it be Republican or Democrat, comes in, decides to prosecute a law that's on the books that makes it illegal, the ramifications of the citizens are currently unknown. The Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, could come in and arrest these people in West Virginia or those other states that we tell that it's legal. So right now I'm trying to get an opinion from the Attorney General or from attorneys as to what would happen to our citizens. We can't make something legal in West Virginia that's illegal federally if it's really in turn going to hurt our own citizens.
Possible federal prosecution is not addressed in the draft legislation or in the laws of other states. Purdue says another thing he'll consider when deciding whether to introduce the bill is the fact that 2014 is an election year, making legislators more hesitant to pass controversial pieces of legislation. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ashton Mara in Charleston.
The petrochemical plant, the Brazilian company Odebrecht, is considering building in Wood County, and a Shell plant proposed for Beaver County, Pennsylvania, are similar to one that Shell already operates in Norco, Louisiana. The town was a battleground over how the chemical industry deals with its neighbors. A key figure in the fight was one very determined school teacher whose only weapon was a plastic bag. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier has more.
Margie Richard is walking on a street with no houses anymore, just lawns.
But that's the backyard of my mom and dad house, which was right there, my mobile home, which was over here.
This is Norco, Louisiana. We're about 300 yards from the Mississippi River, 20 miles or so upriver from New Orleans. Richard is a 71-year-old former school teacher. She points to a tree where her mom used to sit.
She liked to sit outside, but it got to a point she couldn't sit outside because the fumes was always gas. She had to go inside.
The fumes she's talking about were coming from a petrochemical plant owned by Shell a few feet away. Shell built a refinery here in 1916. The New Orleans Refining Company, or Norco, ran the facility, and eventually the town adopted the name as its own. In the 1950s, Shell built a chemical plant near the refinery in an all-black part of Norco called Diamond. Richard grew up next to the plant. But years later, she would lead a fight to have the company relocate the neighborhood that she grew up in. As a child, she grew up smelling foul odors from the plant that she likened to bleach. She also remembers people in the town suffered from health problems, which she blamed on those fumes.
Everybody within these two streets had breathing machines in their house.
Then one day in 1973, a teenager named Leroy Jones started a lawnmower a few feet from a leaking pipeline, sparking an explosion. It killed an elderly woman who lived nearby. Her name was Helen Washington. Richard remembers the scene vividly.
And there on the ground was Miss Helen, who lived in the house under sheet. And I could smell the, you could smell the, her hair. It was just awful.
This was a turning point both for the town and for Richard. She began taking stock of the health problems experienced by people in her neighborhood. Her sister contracted a rare inflammatory disease called sarcoidosis. But the symptoms were so common, her sister didn't realize she had the disease until it was too late.
It's like an allergy. You think you got sinus or whatever. Certain times of the year, seasonal change.
Though there's disagreement over what causes the rare disease her sister had, some scientists think chemical exposures can trigger it. Richard suspects that was the case for her sister, Naomi, who died at the age of 43. Then in 1988, another explosion happened. This time it was at Shell's oil refinery in Norco. The blast killed seven workers and damaged walls and buildings around the town. It was so strong, it set off alarms in New Orleans, 25 miles away. Richard decided to fight Shell to get the company to relocate residents away from both plants. Richard helped bring in an environmental group that monitored air emissions with 5-gallon buckets.
We learned how to capture the air, how to have statistical reports.
The group detected chemicals in the air that Shell had never reported to the state's environmental agency. This caught the attention of the press and regulators. Before long, Richard was being asked to share her findings. She spoke before the UN in the Netherlands, where she confronted a high-ranking Shell executive. She remembers the meeting in which he brought a sample of air taken from Norco.
I stood before at the United Nations with my bag of polluted air.
And she asked the executive, would he like to breathe the air? The gambit worked. A few weeks later, another executive from Shell knocked on the door of her trailer in Norco, wanting to talk. Soon, the company was offering to buy people's houses near the chemical plant with a minimum offer of $80,000. More than 300 families took the buyout, including Richard's. Throughout the campaign, Shell denied that its plant made people in Norco sick. And though it's the subject of much debate, there's no scientific proof that Louisiana's chemical industry has anything to do with the state's high incidence of cancer. According to the CDC, Louisiana has the second highest cancer rate in the country. A Shell spokeswoman says the decision to buy out homes was in no way related to health concerns, but part of a longer-term effort to create a green belt around the chemical plant. Still, even industry backers say big chemical plants in Louisiana are better neighbors these days than they were a generation ago when Richard was fighting Shell.
The industry recognized that it had to do a better job communicating with and listening to the citizens who lived in the communities around them.
Tim Johnson is a public affairs consultant to the petrochemical industry in Louisiana. He says experiences like those at Norco have been part of an evolution the industry has undergone in the past 25 years. Part of this had to do with companies simply wanting to do the right thing. But he even admits part of it was because they were forced to.
You have to be honest to say that a lot of the improvements they've made have been as a result of regulations.
These improvements have cut toxic air releases in Louisiana by about half of what they were in the early 1990s. The EPA now has a program to ensure that black and other minority neighborhoods like the Diamond Section in Norco aren't subjected to inordinate amounts of industrial pollution. Today, Diamond, the neighborhood where Margie Richard grew up, is quiet, except for the hum of Shell's chemical plant. About 40 families stayed here. Instead of being relocated, they received a home improvement grant from Shell. One man who stayed behind is Lionel Brown. On a Saturday afternoon, Brown tinkers with his brother's pickup truck in his driveway.
I saw no reason to move. Yeah. So I didn't want to sell. And then first of all, they wasn't giving enough money for what I had.
What he had was a house and four adjacent lots. Now that air monitors have been installed in the neighborhood, he's also not so worried about pollution. Brown works at a nearby chemical plant for Dow. That makes him feel safer about living next to the Shell plant, even though he knows the chemicals made at his job are dangerous.
They make stuff that'll kill you. Hey, you know, but everything is contained.
Margie Richard now lives 15 minutes away from Norco. She thinks community leaders in Pennsylvania need to pay attention to what Shell is considering for Beaver County.
You should have input in what is going on.
She says it took decades, but Richard thinks the town and the company finally learned this lesson. In Norco, Louisiana, I'm Reed Frazier for the Allegheny Front.
This series by the Allegheny Front in Pittsburgh is paid for in part by the Fund for Investigative Journalism. This is West Virginia Morning. It's 7:46. Partly sunny this morning, a chance of rain this afternoon. Temperatures will be in the 50s. Rain continues tonight and into tomorrow.
Support for NPR comes from the American Jewish World Service, supporting women, girls, and LGBT communities worldwide at ajws.org.
Community colleges around the state are joining forces with universities and four-year colleges to form bonds that will help students continue their education past an associate's degree. Clark Davis has the story.
Last week, Mount West Community and Technical College in Huntington signed an articulation agreement with the College of Arts and Media at Marshall. More specifically, the agreement pertains to students in journalism fields such as advertising, public relations, online journalism, and radio, television production and management. The 2+2 agreement allows students in those fields at Mount West to transfer their associate's degree credits directly to the Marshall School of Journalism, where they can then work toward their bachelor's degree. The idea isn't new for schools throughout the state. Agreements like those at West Virginia Northern Community and Technical College's 2+2 agreement in social work with West Virginia University, or Southern West Virginia Community and Technical College's agreement with Concord University in elementary education, are becoming the norm. Jim Skidmore is the chancellor for West Virginia Community and Technical Colleges.
You know, many community college students start with us not knowing, you know, if they want to pursue a four-year baccalaureate degree. And once they complete the associate degree, then they want to continue their education. So they have the option to do that. I don't think there should be any doors closed for students to pursue additional higher education. So these type of agreements just make it possible to do that.
Skidmore says these agreements are paramount to the success of the students who have a need to start at community and technical colleges around the state.
It promotes the relationships and partnerships with them. And when they work out these partnerships, you know, it's a win-win for everybody. It's a win for community college because they're graduating students and they're sending them on to additional education. It's a win for the baccalaureate institutions for getting these students, and obviously it's a big win for the students because they have an opportunity to pursue a baccalaureate degree if they want to do that.
Marshall University President Stephen Kopp understands the need for these agreements.
We have kind of a general articulation transfer list of courses and so on, But we have been working very diligently on establishing these specific articulation transfer agreements. We have three of them right now in the College of Business. This adds another one, and we're looking at developing others as we go along.
Keith Catronio is president of Mount West Community and Technical College. He says agreements like these are key for their ability to help students continue their education past Mount West.
These program-specific pathways arm them with the information that they need to take the right courses and not stumble around and get confused as they move forward in their degree program. So it makes it much more efficient, much more concrete, and students can know exactly what they need to take here and at the university.
According to the official agreement, the deans of both programs will continually monitor the curriculum at both institutions to ensure consistency and program quality. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Clark Davis in Huntington.
West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Keep up with all the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. We're interested in your comments. You can send them to feedback@wvpublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at @WVPublicNews and find us on Facebook. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Ben Aduccio. Our director is Bob Powell. I'm Beth Voorhees.